Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. It's Soundings from the National Humanities Center. Conversations and commentary featuring scholars and visitors at the center. This is Wayne Pond. The National Humanities Center is an independent, nonprofit institute that encourages excellence in scholarship and affirms the importance of the humanities in American life. Welcome to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Unhappy Endings, two conversations about modern English culture this week on Soundings. You'll hear from two historians, Lawrence Stone of Princeton University and Michael McDonald of the University of Michigan. First, I'll talk to Lawrence Stone about his new book, Road to Divorce, England 1530 to 1987. Following that discussion, I'll talk to Michael McDonald, co-author of Sleepless Souls, Suicide in Early Modern England. Both books are available from Oxford University Press. According to Lawrence Stone, the transition from a non-divorcing society into a culture of separation and divorce is perhaps the most profound social change in English society in the last 500 years. Here is Lawrence Stone.
Well, I begin in 1530 because until the Reformation, there was theoretically no divorce in Catholic countries. They did not exist. Indeed, in Ireland today, it does not exist formally. So that was the obvious place to begin. And what I soon discovered was that England was the only Protestant country which didn't introduce some form of legal divorce. Normally for adultery of the wife, sometimes for the husband, sometimes not. Or cruelty, which meant life-threatening physical cruelty by the man. In England, this didn't happen. In the England never changed its laws, never changed its rules, and carried on as before, for reasons which are extremely obscure, but have to do with politics, and the changes back and forth of religion in England in the 16th century, the personal prejudices of Queen Elizabeth, who was unmarried and didn't want anybody else to marry or divorce or anything. And so the whole thing got stuck. And England went into the early modern period and stayed there with virtually a non-divorcing system.
England didn't have, what, divorce on the books until, when was it, 1857,
that,
something
that
like
that? That is correct.
And what happened then? Why is that a key date?
Well, for about 50 years, people had been demanding change and pointing to other places. They were also horrified by the scandal of the existing system, in which people were getting divorced, but getting divorced in very dubious and doubtful ways.
Just leaving one another, for instance.
Well, that's one of the ways. But what was happening was that the law courts were being really corroded by collusion. People were... would want to separate, and therefore they would falsely accuse one another of adultery, and then just fix it up.
And don't you have a story about a man who took his wife to a divorce proceeding, and he strapped her to a wagon or put her into a stock, something like that? Really pretty crude kind of occurrence.
Now that's wife sales. That's a different story. This is amongst the poor. When, if you were going to break up and you had no legal machinery to do so, how did you do it? And the main thing you wanted to do was to get yourself free from legal obligations to maintain this woman afterwards and just shunt her off onto her new lover. And some people, very few, in the 18th and 19th centuries, adopted this process of saying, okay, we'll treat it as if it's a cattle sale and put a rope around the woman's neck and lead her into a cattle market and say, well, this woman's up for sale. Well, in fact, it wasn't so awful as it sounds.
What, is that a ritual that you're describing?
It's a ritual. I'm describing a public ritual.
Right.
And the object of the exercise was massive publicity in order to try and make it legal that the husband would no longer have any responsibility for this wife. And the man who bought her, that was all prearranged, would then have the responsibility.
Was there or was there not, or to what degree was there a kind of an underground literature by and about women, for instance, that would protest these awful conditions? I take it that we don't have feminism as such until early in the 19th century, but surely women must have expressed themselves about this whole business of being nothing but chattel or little else. Have I got this right?
Well, what is curious is there's very little protest. There was protest in the middle of the English Revolution. John Milton said that divorce should be as we regard it today, where love has disappeared, marriage is broken down, and therefore we might just clean it up.
Uh-huh. And that's a bit of an irony, because he's famous as a sexist for saying he for God and she for God in him, yet he comes along and says, wait a minute, we ought to have marriages that are filled with love and harmony.
That's absolutely right. Well, nobody listened to him. He's crying in the wilderness.
Yeah.
The number of women who were violently protesting against it, were curiously small, as a matter of fact. Their conditions were, I think, extremely disadvantageous. And what was superimposed on this system was, after about 1690, what happened was the great noblemen were coming to Parliament and saying, look here, my wife is committing adultery. I can't sleep with her anymore. I'm the heir of a dukedom and enormous estates, tens of thousands of acres. And if I don't do something and remarry and get an heir, it's all going to pass into other people's hands.
Uh-huh.
What can I do?
And the answer?
Well, the answer was Parliament then, rather grudgingly, allowed these noblemen to divorce their wives for adultery by what was known as a parliamentary divorce.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a bizarre situation of bishops maintaining that divorce was absolutely against God's will and what Christ said, and yet at the same time voting for these anomalies through Parliament, and that was becoming a scandal. People
right.
were scandalized by that.
Heaven versus practicality, theology and practicality.
Yeah. And so people were getting very upset about that.
What about the hypocrisy of the men? I mean, here they're painting themselves as the ones who are being, taken to task, as it were, the women committing adultery. Surely it was not a one-sided issue. I mean,
of course not.
Massive hypocrisy.
It's a massive hypocrisy. What was happening, basically, is almost always, when the women were committing adultery, the men had been committing adultery for decades before that.
Okay.
And they finally got fed up and sought some companionship elsewhere. But this could never come into the court. And therefore, the woman's one leverage was, look, if you don't give me some custody of the children, you don't give me a proper settlement, I'm going to tell the court that you're an adulterer too, in which case we're screwed. Both of us are absolutely stuck.
What about the disparity between affection, love, emotion on the one side, and practicality, property, lineage on the other? Is there an utter polarity there?
Sometimes there is, sometimes there isn't. Sometimes the two go together. On the whole, people tend to marry people within the same economic bracket and status bracket and so on. Sometimes there were frightful rows between the parents, who obviously wanted the child to marry upwards, socially mobile upwards, and the children, who often fell in love and wanted to marry according to suit themselves. So that polarity does exist, and it goes on, and it also exists within each human mind. I mean, both the bride and the groom are looking one another over, not merely for romantic or sexual purposes, but, well, how much money is he going to make? Is he going to give me a decent home?
Right.
And so on.
But as you trace this this line, you call it the road to divorce, Lawrence Stone, as you trace this, enormous saga, how do you figure out the interplay between the public and the private? How do you figure out what kinds of evidence to use? How do you psychologize? How do you use statistics? What was your task as a historian in mapping this road?
Well, the task was to do all these things, both produce statistics of how many people were getting at least legal divorce. So we don't know how many were getting just walking out of the house and slamming the door. That we have no means of telling. My hunch is that there were tens of thousands of people who were bigamists, who simply went out of the door, walked away, walked 50 miles, married again, and the chances of being caught were virtually zero. And I think the 18th and 19th century England was full of it, absolutely full of it.
How many libraries did you have to work your way through in the composition of this book?
Goodness. Well, quite a number, but I had one very lucky break, which was that an appeal court for the whole of southern England, the ecclesiastical court, was abolished in 1857 when the courts the power to divorce was transferred from the ecclesiastical courts to a secular court.
Mm-hmm.
The power being before this of the ecclesiastical court, I should say, they called it divorce, but it wasn't what we call divorce. That is to say, it was separation from bed and board, but without permission to remarry.
I see. So technically, the marriage remained intact. So
marriage remained intact. Theoretically, you weren't allowed to remarry.
Uh-huh.
What happened, of course, was everybody did. Or took a lover, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, this huge body of documents, which was intact from 1660, the Great Fire of London, the previous stuff had been burnt, from 1660 to 1857, it was completely intact.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly it was abolished. Now, what happened next after 1857, we don't know. The story amongst the lawyers by 1890 was that the clerk, in a fit of rage, because he'd lost his job and lost everything, he just threw the whole damn lot down a dry well in St. Paul's Cathedral churchyard.
Not thinking about Lawrence Stone, but
exactly.
Here you came along. Huh?
Well, what happened was that then somebody towards the end of the, at some point, said, look, you can't do this. Let's get this stuff out. It's valuable.
Uh-huh.
It was taken out, put in a cellar in the Archbishop of Canterbury's palace at Lambeth in London, and forgotten. It was forgotten until the 1930s, and then suddenly they unlocked this cellar, and there it was.
Uh-huh. Very briefly, how did you come upon it?
What happened then was that it was catalogued, and then they wrote to me from the palace, the librarian did, and said, mm-hmm. Can you put together a consortium of American universities to microfilm this stuff, because it's too fragile to be used,
mm-hmm.
Which I did. I got 12 universities in America to put down so much money a year for 10 years to buy a copy. And I've been sitting happily in Princeton for 10 years reading this stuff.
Uh-huh. Why divorce? I mean, you step back from your enterprise as a historian and you say, what is it important in society that needs to be told? What stories, what narratives, what large issues? Apart from the fact that you had this wonderful source of materials that you've been describing, why did you look at divorce?
Because it was, I think, on the current agenda.
Mm-hmm.
It's very high on the current agenda. I mean, today, abortion and divorce are the two almost hottest topics.
Yeah.
Divorce is less so now. It's become accepted, but it was then when I began.
What is it? One in 50% of American marriages end in divorce, and one in three in England?
That's correct.
Uh-huh.
That's correct.
Uh-huh. And in contrast to the beginning of this study, you say it was just virtually non-existent.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
So we've gone through an incredible transformation.
Mm-hmm. Lawrence Stone, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. Your book is Road to Divorce, published by Oxford University Press. I have before me here a review that appears in the New York Times, and the reviewer says, just straight out here at the end of the review, Lawrence Stone is now our most impressive living historian. Those are wonderful words. Mm-hmm. What kind of a burden does that create for you, or what kind of a reward does it create for you in your mind? How do you think of the historian's enterprise?
Well, it's obviously hyperbole, and we can't take it too seriously, but it's going to annoy a great many people. Pleases me, of course, but gratifies my ego, but it's going to annoy a lot of other people.
Are you a chronicler, or are you an interpreter of what happened way back there?
I'm not a chronicler, no. I'm an analyzer,
mm-hmm.
and an interpreter, and I like telling stories, too.
Lawrence Stone teaches at Princeton University. You're listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond. Lawrence Stone's new book is Road to Divorce, England 1530 to 1987, available from Oxford University Press. During a recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, Lawrence Stone worked on Volume 2 of his History of Divorce in Modern England. Soundings on Unhappy Endings in Modern European Culture continues. You'll hear next from Michael McDonald, a historian at the University of Michigan. Michael McDonald is co-author of Sleepless Souls, Suicide in Early Modern England, published by Oxford University Press. Sleepless Souls is a history of social attitudes towards suicide, from the prevalence of harsh views about self-destruction in the 16th and early 17th centuries to the toleration that characterized the late 17th and early 18th centuries. Here is Michael McDonald.
Well, suicide was very savagely punished in the 16th and early 17th centuries. Hmm. That may sound surprising, but it is possible to punish a suicide. The the property of the suicide was confiscated by the crown, the movable property of the suicide, mm-hmm. So that his family was deprived of any sort of liquid assets that the suicide might have. That would include things like leases, which vast majority of farming families depended upon for their living. And also, the suicide's body was desecrated after death.
How specifically? What do you mean?
Well, the English custom was to bury the suicide at a crossroads or in a highway with a stake driven through the body.
Oh, my goodness.
Usually at night, actually.
All right. And why at a crossroads? What does that have to do? This is, what, a lesson to the public, that kind of thing?
Yes, actually. And on occasion, pieces of the stake or a part of the stake would be left, actually, above ground so that passersby could be reminded of the deed and dissuaded from committing it themselves.
All right. Now, this punishment for people who committed suicide stems, I take it, principally from religious or theological impulses, and we're going to get away from that. What direction does the attitude toward suicide take?
Well, those are two questions. The point I'd like to make is that there were two shifts in attitudes to suicide. The first occurred around 1500, when the crime began to be prosecuted for the first time, really, very severely and very frequently. The second occurred after 1660 or perhaps 1680, in which a more tolerant attitude to suicide began to emerge and a more tolerant set of responses. The law was suspended in effect on a case-by-case basis.
And now, how do you figure out the question of tolerance or intolerance, Michael McDonald? If you're looking mainly at legal records, how is it that you get back into the minds of men and women in the 18th century to arrive at this notion of tolerance in contrast to intolerance?
It's very difficult, actually, as you can imagine. You can really do two things. The first is to try to place the legal records and the patterns you find in them in the broadest possible historical context by examining theological tracts, administrative edicts, the law itself. And the second is to look at the circumstances of individual deaths as closely as you can. Occasionally, you can get quite a lot of information about particular deaths.
And how do you play that that tension, I take it, or that is it a disparity between statistics on the one hand and individual compassionate anecdotes on the other?
No, actually. It's fortunately for me, it's worked out very well. One can see in the pattern of inquests a very clear trend towards intolerance, and that is to say, towards a more rigorous enforcement of the law in the 16th century.
On the part of the coroners.
On the part of the coroners and their juries. This is a very peculiar institution made up of local men, many of whom probably knew the deceased themselves, basically his neighbors. Huh. And coroners' juries in England could exercise a certain amount of independence in their own findings. So one is looking not merely at an official response, but at a response on the part of the community mm-hmm. to a particular death. And what one can see is a rising severity up really until the English Revolution of 1640 to 1660. And then one can see a declining willingness to enforce the law with its full rigor after that.
Now, you mentioned at one point in describing your book, Michael McDonald, about suicide in early modern English history, that there was a set of philosophical arguments excusing suicide. Tell me about that.
One of the interesting paradoxes that the history of suicide raises is that as attitudes grew more severe in the 16th century, they also produced as a kind of counterpoint a revival of older beliefs, classical beliefs, that excused suicide. And these were philosophical, especially Stoic and Epicurean ideas. Everyone knows that suicide was condoned in Roman times. And certainly in this period when everybody who was educated had a classical education, everyone knew that as well. And there were also a set of medical ideas that from the classical period that were revived, which were inconsistent with the punishment of suicide, which essentially argued that it was a the consequence of mental illness, and thus, logically, everyone should have been found non compos mentis.
Mm-hmm. Now, that sounds very modern, Michael McDonald. You, again, are a historian of early modern England. That means, what, 16th, 17th, 18th centuries?
Yes.
You could be talking about the 1990s. Are we essentially the same in our attitudes? When I say we, I mean, you know, here we got the Americans on one side, the British on the other. How do you figure that out?
No, we're profoundly different. The attitudes which promoted severity towards suicide in the 16th century were far more appealing to ordinary people and indeed to the intelligentsia than attitudes condoning it.
Because of religious belief? Because of the church?
Suicide was regarded as a supernaturally evil act. Uh-huh. And in fact, the common people came to believe that it was caused literally by the devil or by evil spirits, a belief that was promoted by the clergy. So that attitudes were based on a worldview which was profoundly vibrant with supernatural forces and profoundly religious in a way that it's very difficult for us to understand.
You could be talking about the Salem witchcraft trials, that is to say, the palpability, the believability, the credibility of this other world that would prompt certain human acts that weren't necessarily condoned.
Exactly. In the rise and fall of the serious, severe prosecution of suicide coincides almost identically with the rise and fall of witchcraft prosecutions.
Mm-hmm.
Both were regarded as supernatural crimes. What happens after the revolution of 1640 to 1660 is those attitudes that you called modern, which were actually classical, ancient, far from being the property of a few advanced philosophical skeptics, became the common coin of polite conversation.
In other words, secular. They became current in the secular society.
Exactly. There was a massive and quite pronounced secularization of attitudes towards suicide, which was promoted at once by the much more widespread dissemination of these older philosophical views, and the elaboration of new attitudes, which were associated with neoclassicism and with later with the Romantic movement.
Well, not to mention the fact that people couldn't do anything about this. I mean, who's to gain by continuing, as it were, to punish the survivors of people, men and women, who take their own lives?
The worry was that if the penalties for suicide were suspended and people weren't punished anymore, that there would be an epidemic of suicide, that the only way to prevent the crime was to insist on the responsibility of the individual to his family.
Does this topic, suicide in the early modern world, does it have any kind of an instructive dimension?
I think the most interesting aspect from that point of view is that is to realize how profoundly our sense of the significance of suicide is shaped by broader social attitudes and cultural changes. There's a lot of attention in modern times to the suicide rate, for instance, and one of the things that this study shows, as many others have, as a matter of fact, is that a suicide rate is as much a reflection of cultural attitudes as it is the actual incidence of the actual incidence of self-killing.
You make me think about, speaking of statistics, I'm sure they're very much out of date, but I remember a number of years ago reading that Marin County, California, has what, one of the highest per capita income rates, and yet it also has one of the highest rates with respect to alcoholism and suicide. These terrible tensions that exist.
Yes, although it's always tempting, I think, to leap to conclusions from suicide statistics, and in fact, most of the time they're not very meaningful for a number of complicated reasons. Come back to the 18th century for a second to show how suicide statistics can be deceiving and our impression of them can be deceiving.
Uh-huh.
England in the 18th century was regarded as the suicide capital of the world, the most fatal nation, it was often said. And yet there's no evidence that suicide was in fact more frequent in England than it was elsewhere. The impression was most likely created by the fact that England then as now had an active gutter press, which traded on the sensational and often wrote up suicides. So they were more frequently publicized in England than elsewhere. But in fact, the statistics do not show any clear trend towards a rising suicide rate in the 18th century.
Don't trust those reporters, in other words.
No. And another common belief then as now is that suicide is more common in the winter than the summer. November was the fatal month.
Or the holidays.
People kept saying. And yet, in truth, in the period between 1500 and 1800, just as now, suicide rates peak in the late spring and early summer. That's true. That's been true the world over, and it's true also in widely disparate cultures. It's a finding which apparently has some basis in biochemical responses to the changing seasons, although we don't know anything about it. But the main point I want to make is that the popular conviction that there is a seasonal correlation between gloom outside and gloom inside and the actuality
of
the statistical death is wrong. Mm-hmm. And so what one discovers is that whenever one talks about perceived frequency and even suicide rates, is that you're dealing in a history of illusions and delusions, a history which in which it's very difficult to separate statistics from the attitudes of the people who actually produce them by certifying a death as a suicide.
Here's a footnote to our conversation. Michael McDonald, you're co-author of a book about suicide in modern society. It's called Sleepless Souls. Does this book have any solace? Does it offer any advice to people who survive, the people who live on after a suicide occurs in the family or a close friend?
I wish it did. In fact, that was the one subject about which I could find virtually no information, was what happened to the survivors. It's especially crucial, obviously, during this period when suicide was severely punished and they were likely to lose their livelihoods as a result of the death of their loved one. But I'm afraid no one kept records, so I have very little information about how people coped with a suicide. I wish I did.
Michael McDonald teaches at the University of Michigan. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Michael McDonald is co-author of Sleepless Souls, Suicide in Early Modern England, available from Oxford University Press. During a recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, Michael McDonald worked on a history of the mind in early modern England. Soundings on Unhappy Endings in Modern English Culture is available on cassette. Send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Ask for program number 549. That's program number 549. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. When you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center is eager to hear your comments about Soundings. Next week, overviews of two recent conferences at the center. The topics will be North America's Hispanic literary heritage and the cultural dimensions of giving and exchange. You'll hear from scholars from Kenyon College, the University of California at Santa Barbara, Princeton University, and the University of Houston. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.